Welcome, everybody. This is The Disposable Web, the sequel to the Social Business Hangout podcast series, available on iTunes. My guest today is...
Hey, everybody. My name is Ron Tite. I'm the CEO of The Tite Group, and we're a content marketing agency based in Toronto. I'm also a speaker and a business expert on Dream Funded, a new show on CTV, and author and, host of Monkey Toast, an award-winning comedy show, and a whole bunch of other stuff.
You and I have met each other maybe six times in real life, but the beauty of stuff like Facebook and stuff like that, I've been able to see the growth. Not necessarily from your stand-up comedy days, but more from your conference speaker days to, you know, the creative director that you are, to now having your own company with your own brand. You are the Tite in the Tite. Tell me maybe about your company, because I want to eventually get to how you got there, but maybe elaborate on what you do professionally.
We think we're the kind of the contemporary version of content marketing. And we just really produce stuff that, you know, people want to see, opposed to advertising that they have to see. And there's far too many opportunities for people to skip ads, to ignore ads, to consume content that doesn't feature ads. And so it's getting increasingly difficult for brands to connect with consumers and their prospects. And so we just help them do that. So, we're the content agency of record for Johnson & Johnson and Microsoft and Yellow Pages on the B2B side and AB World Foods and then a couple of smaller brands. But we really focus on big global brands who really have the sophistication to do the type of work that we like to do.
When you bring up the word content marketing, that's a word that's been bandied about for a few years now. It's right up there with personal branding in many ways. Do the two play hand in hand?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know about content marketing but marketing in general, yeah, 100%. That, you know, individuals, the personal brands within organizations really have to be aligned with the organizational brands that they represent. And because if a consumer, comes across, has an interaction with a brand, and the person delivering that interaction doesn't live up to the expectations that have been communicated, it all goes away. All that money is wasted. So, the people who work within a brand have to deliver on the promise that they gave to the external consumer. So, yeah, I mean, I guess marketing and personal branding is 100% completely aligned.
When you add the content creation and the content marketing aspect of it, you as a personal brand, because like I said, I knew you more as the host of a conference than you what you do professionally. I was never your client, you were never my client, that business relationship wasn't there. So, but you had a sense of who Ron Tite was. You know, he was humorous, he was genuine, he was surrounding himself with insightful people, and as I always like to say, every time I have a chat with an insightful person, if I walk away but with 0.00002% of that knowledge, it adds up over time. So you've got that infusion of all that insight. You now decide to run your own larger company where the personal brand of the content marketing that you were creating and the agency that was you, you're now entrusting people that aren't you to be you. How does that play out? Because I guess this is where the shift, to your point, it's great to say I'm going to hire a whole bunch of people that believe in what I believe in every time I wake up every day. That's your thing.
You're right. It is a tricky proposition. And, I joke often with the folks on our team, and I say, hey, don't fuck this up because my name's on the door and I can't get another job if you mess this up. You can't. You can just, just go walk away from the Tite Group and not worry about it. My name's on the door, so, my personal reputation is on the line. But, you can't really think of it that way. The Tite Group is its own entity. And, I often say here, less Tite, more group. This can't be about Ron because you can't scale Ron. And by the way, there are way smarter people here than Ron. So let's dial up the group aspect of that. when I started the agency, I didn't, you know, to be completely honest, I just called it the Tight Group. One, because I wasn't exactly sure what it was going to be. And so I thought, well, let's just keep it, you know, kind of loose and flexible. The other thing was that, you know, agencies these days, you spend far too much time, you know, coming up with ridiculous sounding, clever names. And my gut says they spent way more time coming up with the name than they did on the business model and the clients that are going to support that name. So I said, you know what, Tight Group, done. Let's do it. Let's move on. Let's start building the business. I also thought that it was important in this day and age that there be people associated with the brand because it's the ultimate in accountability. It's tough to keep a brand accountable. It's much easier, you know, to keep a person accountable. So it's kind of the dance between those two things. You know, client, we just had a pitch the other day on Monday, and their question was, so Ron, how involved are you? And, hey, we're 25, 26 people now, and we're growing. So, yeah, the reality is I don't attend every meeting, and I'm not in the weeds. I'm thinking about tomorrow while the team is thinking about today.
That's the other aspect of it as well, is as you as the individual becomes in demand, you become now a premium service to the larger organization. So, you know, I remember back in the IT days, I was one of the few people that could still talk sales, marketing, business, you know, commerce. So I was always being, you know, the sales engineer, the geek that you bring along to put in front of everybody else. And from that, you know, you really sense that you were brought in when the close needed to be done, when the original impression had to be done, or the little bit of, nowadays it would be the webinar with the CEO of the company, or, a podcast, but, you know, from our good friend Mitch, who's, you know, iconic, show leads everybody to his business, you know what I mean? So those things, I think, still play, and it becomes a premium aspect of, you can have Ron. We've made Ron better because we've added all these extra pieces to it. Like I said, the group with the tight, it's like everything else. As a personal brand that has created content yourself, that has built an iconic name with a team supporting it, that becomes the value proposition because, you know, you've met Seth Godin. So you know all about, you know, the lowest common denominator. And, you know, you'll often say, you know, if you've got two paintings and one's an artist that you love and the other one is an artist you don't know, you'll pay more because it's the artist that you know that you want. You want to have that photo taken by that guy. You want that video done by this guy. I want this album mixed by this guy. You know, you become the guy. But you have an operational necessity, as you say, to be able to deal with that slew of inbound requests. So maybe the question there, that was more of a rant more than anything else, but the question out of that really is, what have you learned in that shortest period of time so far about that handoff? Or more importantly, you just hired a creative director. You are a creative director. What do you look for in the person that really is doing what you used to do?
I guess I'll answer the first question first and then the second one on the creative director. So what have I learned? Man, owning your own business is a lot more difficult than it seems from the outside. I remember that when we were probably a year and a half ago, we had just, you know, got a big client, we had to staff up and stuff. And the accountant came to me and said, we're not going to make payroll. I was like, what? We just billed like a big whack of money. And she's like, yeah, it hasn't come in yet. And we've hired all these people, so we're not going to make payroll. And I was like, oh, that's cash flow. Right. And so there were a whole bunch, as a creative guy, there were a whole bunch of sides to the business that I thought I was, you know, I was always a more business-focused creative director, but there was still a whole bunch of stuff that I had no idea about. And so, you know, what have I learned? Well, one, you really got to know your strengths. And just because your name's on the door doesn't mean that you need to do everything. And if you are doing everything, there's no way you're going to grow. And there's no way you're going to really do great work because one person can't have strengths in all the areas that it requires, that a business requires. So one, you know, find out what you're good at and, you know, spend more time on that. And then find out what you're not good at and backfill yourself. So hire people who can, you know, can support those weaknesses. And once you've hired them, let them do their job. So don't micromanage. Don't get in the way. Oftentimes, I realize, you know, that I'm the bottleneck. That I'm the bottleneck in a lot of stuff. And you know, so you gotta step back and let people do their job. Now, the creative director was a great example of that, where, you know, it started out, you know, this whole agency just started out as me behind a desk, one person. And then as we got a little busier, it's like, ooh, I need some help on the day-to-day details and finance and stuff, so I brought in a president. And then as the work, as we started to get busier, and I personally started to get busier, I started noticing the work started to slip, and I started noticing that my passion for getting in the weeds of the work started to decrease because there's so many other demands on my time. And that is a recipe for disaster. So I realized, hey, you know what? I can't be creative director anymore. And so, you know, I started looking around and I knew Jamie King before. We hadn't worked together, but I certainly knew him. And we were just grabbing a coffee and I thought, he's the guy. He gets it. He would be a great fit. Now, his first question, which it should have been, was, you know, so how involved are you going to be? which is totally fair, right? It was a very big leap, but one that had to happen when I got to the point where I said, I'm not going to be involved at all. I mean, not at all, but it's your game, that you're in charge of that, that you're accountable for the work, and I will come when invited and when I feel the need to kind of step in, but I also knew I had to fight that desire to hop in. Because it was his responsibility, and I had to, you know, realize like, hey, sometimes I'm not gonna agree all the time, and let's just talk it out and have a good honest conversation about it. And if he still feels strongly about something, I gotta let him do that, because he's got to own the wins and the losses. And so yeah, you know, finding out what you're good at, hiring people who can do the stuff you're not good at, and let them do their job.
Your example when you were talking about the creative director, you know, brought up in many ways Dave Grohl to me. And the reason I mentioned that is when he started the Foo Fighters, he went through a whole bunch of drummers before he found a drummer that he could basically say, it's your gig. Because he would have the other drummers do the drum tracks and basically say, well, that's not what I imagined, or that's not what I would have done. So he basically just redo all the drum tracks, and basically the drummer would leave out of frustration because their creative outlet was, okay, so I'm here, what, for what reason? For live shows only? I got to do your drum tracks? I come from a very logical world, and I'm shifting to a very creative world, which is, you know, your typical 40s, for lack of a better statement. But, you know, in the logical world, arguments were logical. There was a yes, there was a no, there was a one, there was a zero. There may have been an if, then, else. But for all cases, it was a very logical, you're right, I'm wrong, move on. Creative is such a grayish, interpretive, you know, the client loves it, blesses the artwork, doesn't run an ad campaign, wonders why no one saw it, all of a sudden they hate it. Well, what was it?
Yeah.
It was it the execution of the marketing, or was it the idea? You know, so the same applies when you got a mix of creative people in the same room is, it's your own perception, not the client's perception, not the audience's perception. How does that world play out in your world? Because I'm sure you're bumping into it more and more, even with just dealing with clients where you think this is funny, they think it's stupid, move on. Like, talk to me a bit about that.
When I recruited Jamie to the role, what I loved, I mean, obviously, you know, there has to be a connection with values and how you define great work and all that kind of stuff, which we were totally on the same page with. But what was really interesting was Jamie's an art director by trade. Before he was a creative director, he was an art director and designer. So that right away, because with my background as a writer, that's a completely different perspective to begin with. So I knew that I wouldn't be comparing writing to writing or a writer's perspective to a writer's perspective, and it would be unique as it was. Plus, at that stage of development, I thought it would be great if we had, you know, the potential that I could step in as junior copywriter, if need be. I hired the unique perspective, and the creative would be developed in a way that I wouldn't have seen it that way, opposed to tweaking, you know, a similar perspective. know, in terms of pitching creative, and yeah, you're right, you know, it is subjective, and you just got to do the right thing, you know. It's just being really confident to, on one hand, go, no, I've thought about this. This is the right way to do it. And trying to not convince and manipulate a client, but to just to give your perspective, and hopefully they see where you're coming from. And if not, being confident enough to look at it again and go, maybe they're right, you know. You know, one of the mantras we have here, which we kind of exaggerate a little bit, but it's that nobody knows. So if somebody comes in and says, hey, this is exactly what you need to do, they're lying. They don't, nobody knows. There's so many things that are changing on a daily basis. There's new platforms coming out. There's new rules of engagement. There's algorithms that are changing every day. So to come in and go, yep, this is the plan you need, that's a lie. So what we try and do is to go, look, we know that there's got to be a better way to do this each and every day. Let's just commit to figuring it out. And we have a certain perspective based on our experience and based on, you know, benchmarks. But we also know those benchmarks are changing every single day. And so that takes an incredibly confident agency and group of people to go, yeah, maybe we're wrong. Who knows? But we'll get it right.
The nice thing, and this is what I love about creative, is it's been, the creative spirit has been consistent throughout the ages, regardless of technology, regardless of business boundaries or cultural, you know, diversity or whatnot. At the end of the day, the mechanisms for getting it in the eyes of the people that will see value in the creative and convert that to a call to action, you're right, that changes per second. You know, is it Meerkat? Is it Periscope? Where do I put all my money? Where do I run an ad? What do I promote or do I don't promote? Do I shift to, you know, my own content versus a hosted versus not? You know, all of those things are constantly changing. But, you know, as we always know, the thing that gets people excited, the things that resonate with them content-wise, the things that answer the question that they're posing, the things that fill their needs and wants, that never changes. And if you could put a good creative piece around those needs and wants and put it in front of the audience in question, if there's no conversion there, you're either providing a product that's poorly priced, does not say what it's supposed to do, or you pitched it to the wrong people. It's quite often the creative is almost that fourth element, yet it's the thing that's easily pointed to because it's great.
Even though everything is changing every single day, there are some simple truths which do not change. And one is that, you know, every brand out there is, they're not competing against the leading brand in their category. They're competing against the internet. So if you can't compete, you know, against Charlie Bit My Finger, you're dead in the water, because there's way more interesting stuff out there for consumers to spend their time on. And you think they're going to spend your time on your direct mail piece? Good luck. They got more stuff over here that's far more compelling, way more interesting, way more timely. And there isn't this bias of you know, the pitch slap of people, of brands having a bias or an ulterior motive of like, yeah, we're trying to be interesting and everything else, but in the end of the day, we want you to buy our product. So that's the environment brands are competing in. And if you're not good enough and interesting enough, you'll lose. Doesn't matter what platform you're on. Doesn't matter whether, you know, again, you're Periscope or Meerkat or what. You are going to lose because there's way more interesting things that consume their time. So, you know, we certainly try and infuse that in everything we do. And, you know, one way of being interesting is being compelling. Another way of being interesting is solving a problem that if you can save their save time or save money or make their life better so they can get back to the stuff that they really, really love, then you'll succeed. The consumers want to get in and get out for most of the categories. If you're a bank, they don't love banks. Face it. They don't love banks. They want to get in. They want to get out. So add value, solve problems, be interesting, and let them move on.
That's exactly to your point. Like Google way back when referred to it as the zero moment of truth. As long as you're relevant at that zero moment of truth and you're easy to find when that happens again, You know, one's discovery, the other one's search, right? So I'll discover you at the zero moment of truth because my need is there and you're there to fill it. And then if you've done such a good job with me during that one interaction, I'll search for you afterwards for repeat business. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, the zero moment of truth certainly is in the search world. And I think people went a little hyperkinetic on SEO. You know, not that it's not important, but if you're writing articles and force-fitting, you know, search keywords in there, and it sounds unnatural, and it just sounds like it's, you know, it's been written with a robot in mind that's going to, you know, affect search algorithms, well, you're dead in the water. You know, you're not going to be genuine, you're not going to be authentic, and you're not going to have that, you know, that halo that comes from just being a good, real, genuine brand. So I think we overextended a little bit in SEO world. Not that it's not important; it really is. But I think what the zero moment of truth did was, you know, zero moment of truth played on an old Procter and Gamble model, which was the first moment of truth, which was, you know, when a person comes into store and what are they facing on shelf, and that there's a new moment of truth that occurs before that. And Google is 100% right that when something happens in my life, oh, it's cold, I need a new coat, or my car just died, I need a new car, people go, all right, and they turn to the search world to go, what's out there? Now, what they might be looking for is they might be looking for a product. Often, though, they're not looking for products, they're looking for solutions. So nobody goes in, you know, and says, I'm looking for, a Microsoft Office. They're looking for how does my office become more productive, or they're looking for efficient ways of storing my files, and then oh look at this, you know, cloud storage kind of comes up. So they're looking for solutions to their problems. They're often not looking for products, and hopefully you've got enough halo that when your brand is there percolating. Then they go, oh yeah, I like those guys. Yeah, let's check out what they have.
Now all of a sudden, because you're not necessarily knowing what you're looking for what you need, not the product name or whatnot, you now also get that discovery point where a company that didn't exist 2 days ago got a TechCrunch review that now is trending as an SEO term on that same question, and boom, you're now going, oh, I don't even know who these people are. So your next step to your point there is, you're searching for the reviews. You're searching, you know, do these guys, did they pay to get here? Do they actually have something? Because, you know, Meerkat as the example. Simple landing page with like a 10-character statement of what the product does, which is basically, we do this. So if a person's searching for, I need this, you get the hit and it's a point of conversion. Boom, that's it. That's their website, you know. And I think you see that more on the landing pages as opposed to the corporate brochures. But I think your videos, your audios, your spots, your you know, whatever they are more that short piece. This is what we do. You're looking for this right now. Yes, contact us. Pure landing page conversion, right? The reason I bring up these conversation is you do something that not every person that runs a marketing company does. You do a lot of conferences, but you do it from the stage. You don't do it from the crowd. You do work the crowd, don't get me wrong, but you're introduced to the cream of the crop of the writing world, especially in the industry that you represent. Typically marketing, entrepreneurship, sales, you know, big plug to the Art of guys, basically, right? You're having behind-the-scenes conversations. They may be 2 minutes. They may be 3 minutes. You're listening to them behind the stage. You're taking notes because I know at the end of the event, you tend to go, these are the 20 things that I picked up from today. And you kind of do almost a little poem slash, you know, rap or whatever you want to call it. You pick up these little insights along the way. What are some of the things that you got from there? From that space, because there's what you learn from the people you work with, what you learn from your clients, and then there's what you learn from your peers. You got an extra tier there that most people have to pay a lot of money to see it from the crowd, not from where you stand.
Most of what I do are kind of, you know, the 1 hour keynotes where I go into an organization or a conference and deliver a 1 hour speech and then I'm gone. So in that case, I love applying my theory or philosophy to a specific category or organization, right? And every time out, I kind of, it's a great challenge to test the thinking. Like, does it apply to these people? And if it does, how does it apply? If it's, I just on Sunday did a keynote for the Canadian Real Estate Association. Well, what's it like for those people? And then, I've done auto parts manufacturers and Pepsi and RBC, all these different industries. So it gives me a great opportunity to connect with people in those categories, do a little bit of a deep dive on that industry and see what I think of what those people should do. In the art of stuff, which I think is really the only thing I host now, it's phenomenal, getting to, hang out with friends like Mitch Joel and Scott Stratton and getting introduced to people like Gary Vaynerchuk and Seth Godin and spending time with them. And then kind of, the Colin Powells and the Rudy Giulianis of the world and people that, I'm not calling enough to go grab a coffee with. But getting that perspective is really valuable, both to me personally as well as to the agency that I represent, because you're just constantly getting different perspectives. And I want to know what Gene Simmons thinks of the marketing world. And is all of it going to be relevant to what I do and to my clients? No. But maybe 2% is. And maybe, there's something else in there that makes me think, oh, that's not appropriate. But if I spun it this way, that's a really interesting insight. So I just get kind of a great behind the scenes look at what those folks are doing. And then because I do a ton of speaking on my own, it's really getting to see how I can improve in that area and, continue to deliver value, both from the content that I speak about, as well as just how am I behaving as a speaker? How do I be even more professional, and how do I behave in a way that people would want to work with me? Because I've seen some jerks there too. Those are great lessons that there's no price on that. The Art of guys, Chris and Scott, are wonderful guys, and they've built a really interesting business that's having a significant impact, I think, on Canadian business leaders. And it's wonderful to attend as you've seen as somebody in the audience. Well, it's even way better attending from the stage.
You brought up Mitch Joel, and he's someone that I admire as well. And I've always said this is a man that's had 400+ podcast interviews with basically the roving list of people that have done book sales. He's probably on the publisher's list of he's on the circuit. Everybody that writes a book goes through Mitch. And I listen to that, and I'm going, here's a man that's just had his company purchased, has got amalgamated into a much larger organization, and has had 400 touch points of diverse viewpoints. That knowledge is priceless to whoever bought them. You get the same thing yourself to a certain degree with what you do. Where does that play into the people that are fronting companies? Has that become the norm? Has that become the bar? The days of a CEO being behind his desk, not willing to talk to people, let alone getting in front of a camera, let alone, whatever, are those gone when all of a sudden they're competing with the likes of, let's be honest, you?
I don't think they're gone. I think the way I'm doing it is one way to do it. It's not the only way, though. Yeah, they like to be in an office. Maybe they're a finance person and they've got that perspective and they've built very successful companies. So, no, it's not the only way to do it. It's certainly the way that plays to my strengths and the way that I have more fun doing it. Mitch is a great friend. And when I left, well, even before I left the previous job I was in at your RSCG, I went to Mitch to get his perspective on balancing the world of speaking and thought leadership with running an agency. And, we have slightly different models in how we approach things, and we're involved in different things in the agency. But again, that plays to personal strengths more than anything. And yeah, I think, we're not that active. We're a content agency, and we're not that active from an agency perspective on social. The tight group isn't got, 10 million followers, because there's only so much you can do. So, we do a great job in the live content channel. That's what we do a great job at. And you don't have to do everything. That's where it really comes to life for us. And it means I'm on the road, and it means I'm the person that's there. Now, some clients may look at that and go like, well, you know, are you really involved in a business, or are you just a face for the business and you're just on the road really just speaking? And the truth is, most CEOs, if they're not on the road speaking or doing something, they're doing other things to develop new business. They're spending days filling out mindless RFPs or whatever that's pulling them away from the business. So I choose to spend my time building our organization this way, and it works. And other people choose to spend their time in other ways, and it works for them. But it works for me, and it's a heck of a lot of fun.
It plays to your strengths. You fill in the gaps for the areas that you don't have. And to your point, you find a niche that you resonate with, and you target that niche. So to your point, you're not an RFP guy, so you're not necessarily going to be targeting the RFP bids. Well, that leaves a market for those that target RFP bids and have people that just love crunching RFPs. Great. We're a population of, 7 billion people. I'm pretty sure there's enough business for every niche you can think of. And, one of the big things that I talk about when I talk about the disposable web is our cost of doing business, like this call right now, this conversation, this whatever this is, costs me nothing other than, my hydro. That money that we're saving allows us to say, I now no longer need 10,000 clients. I've always said, you need 3 good clients. If you've got a business model, and what I mean by that is the individual. As you scale, that becomes 6. Yeah. Not, what I mean? But when I used to have people that I would hire, let's say 100 grand a year, I would say, I expect to make 300,000 from you. That is the conversion of me bringing you on board. So that 3 good clients is kind of, something that I've always liked about that 1-to-3 ratio. And that's scalable, as you say, if you bring in people that are willing to fit the pieces that you don't want. But the last piece he said there, it's fun. I truly believe we have so many opportunities now in front of us. Not do something that's fun or that's stressing you out will show in the work that you do. A person commuting 2 hours in stop traffic in Toronto and arrives at the office frustrated is not going to be the person you necessarily want to have to pick up the phone with your most irate client. Yeah.
No way.
Because at the end of the day, one bad statement, you've lost that client no matter what your branding is. So you got to enjoy what you do, or I think you're doomed to fail regardless of whether or not you know what you're doing.
It has to be a balance, right? I mean, there was this, people tell you, follow your passion and the money will follow. Yeah, to a certain extent. But you also have to have a business model around your passion. And you have to be able to say, okay, how am I going to do this, and how am I going to make a living at this, and how am I going to grow, and how's it going to get better, and everything else. In my comedy background, I came across people who were way funnier, way more talented, who never really got beyond, performing, the same 15-minute set at their local Yuck Yuck, because they just didn't see the business side of it. They were kind of chasing their passion, but they weren't systematic about it. They weren't strategic about it. They weren't focused about it. And I'm not saying that you need to be a millionaire, that you need to make a lot of money, but you need to make enough money that you can always stay enthused and intrigued, and that you want to grow it, and that you want to get better at it. So yeah, chase the passion, but what's the business model around the passion? Because, passion doesn't put food on your table. A business model does.
The word motivation, or what motivates you, plays into that, I think, to a certain degree. We throw the word passion out there, but everybody's passionate about different things or whatnot. But I think the business plan that's aligned with the passion will give you that motivation, as well as the benchmarks to assess. Like, I'm a big iterative guy, give me a scrum any week, right? And you do more of what works and you do less of what doesn't work. And that's, you do that and you, as I like to say, you iterate to success.